As a reminder, the information provided in this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended to be a substitute for professional advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek advice of your therapist or qualified mental health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or mental health disorder. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this podcast. The host, guests, and podcast network are not responsible for any actions or decisions you make based on the information provided. Now, let's dive right in. Hello, friends, and welcome once again to everybody's favorite therapy-themed podcast. This is This Changes Everything. I'm your host, Sarah, and with me this week is a very special guest. His name is Dr. Adolph Brown III, a.k.a. Doc Brown. He is a renowned businessman, clinical psychologist, and parenting expert with over 3 decades of experience. He offers inspiring masterclasses blending humor with profound insights. He's the founder of Doc Brown Productions and Doc Brown Global. He's the recipient of numerous awards, including the E.L. Hamm Master Teacher Award, and his impact extends globally, empowering individuals and organizations to learn, laugh, and lead. And we are so excited to have him on the show. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. You know, I love having mental health professionals, and you have like the longest list of accolades and awards and everything like after your name. I'm so honored to have you here. And before we even dive into like what I really want to get talking about today, I want to talk a little bit about your background. What brought you into the work that you do? Because as we were talking about before we pressed record, everybody in the mental health field, or anybody even around the mental health field, didn't get there by accident. And there's always a story there. So tell me what landed you in this role.
Well, a few things. Well, first of all, I had some very traumatic events happen early in life. Right around 2 years old, my mom and dad had been married many years. There were 5 of us. And my father woke up one day and decided that he didn't want that anymore. He didn't want to be married anymore. And we left a solidly middle-class upbringing to go to inner-city poverty overnight. So
that's a big disruption at 2 years old during that important attachment phase.
Definitely, definitely. And I missed my dad. And he was a loving father. He still stayed connected and committed. However, at 2, I thought maybe I had something to do with it. and it was kind of reinforced as I grew up. When I would talk to people about my father, they say, "Oh yeah, he left right around the time you were born." So I would kind of
internalize that. Of course, what other messages does a little baby pick up from that?
Exactly. Aww. So that was one. Then my oldest sibling and only brother Oscar became my hero. Of course, in the absence of my dad, my grandparents also were significant participants in my journey. They were farmers. And I say that because that's a huge part of who I am today, not necessarily the farmer, but the attributes of a farmer. I tell people all the time, you might be smarter than me, but it'll be really hard to outwork me.
Yeah.
You know, on the farm, there wasn't a quitting time. You know, we finished when the work was done. So my brother became my hero, and my brother was murdered when I was 11.
Oh, my goodness.
So these things.
So you lost 2 father figures, really, in a way.
Definitely.
Man.
Definitely. And very fortunate to have a grandfather that treated me like a son, and both grandma and granddad. But I had a very, very strong village. But one of the things that kind of haunted me was the fact that I thought about revenge for my brother on a regular basis. I wasn't angry, and you know, I worked with children and families all over the country. I was enraged. There's a difference.
Talk about that. The difference for you.
Well, the difference is that anger isn't good or bad. Is what you do with it. Rage truly serves no purpose. Rage is an intense negative emotion that does more harm to the vessel that contains it.
Yeah, it does kind of have this effect where it bleeds into everything else in your life too, and creates like that real seeing red kind of.
That's right. You know, I say, and you mentioned bleeding. I mentioned that rage is often you bleed on people who didn't cut you.
Oh, that is so beautiful and
so
meaningful.
So I was enraged, and I had my principal, my elementary school teachers, everyone cheering for me. And I tell people all the time, if you got one person that believes in you, that goes such a long way. But I had many. And my principal had enrolled me at, well, asked my mom if he could enroll me in boxing. And
that is really a good thing. That is a great place to put an enraged child. There you go.
Exactly. So people didn't get it. You know, he was really talking about social emotional learning. The things that I learned in boxing are the things that schools are trying to teach today. I learned to sit on my hands in anger. I learned that boxing with anger, you're surely to lose. I learned that just really life lessons in boxing. And the only reason he decided to do that, or at least take the chance with me with that, is my mom would often get phone calls that I'd been in fights. I'd never started any fights. I wasn't that kid. And my mom would always ask that of the principal. The first question, did he start? My principal would say, no, no, no. But his teachers say he's a really good fighter. So, yeah.
You weren't starting it, but you were finishing it.
I know that lingo pretty well. So, I was in the police boxing league. I was the only kid in that gym for a long time. And that did so much for me in life. Some of the research and some of the trainings that I do today is because I talk about the difference between looking at people and seeing people. So in our community, there wasn't a very good relationship with the police. Mm-hmm. And it was, both ends.
Right.
However, what ended up happening, I was able to see them without their uniforms. They were able to see me without the rage and without running from them.
Like so, humanize the person.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's so interesting that through something like what a lot of people would perceive as a very violent sport, it humanizes. You learn that like connection with people through that.
Oh, definitely. Process.
That's interesting and not what you'd expect maybe.
And sometimes people confuse boxing with fighting. My coach, my very first boxing coach would say, boxing is a sweet science. Fighting is not.
Yeah. And one is a lot about control and the other one is about being out of control.
Exactly. And not necessarily control as much as regulating.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. Which is what we do with our emotions, which is what we do with so much. Oh,
yes. 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 So, again, my brother was there, big hero, and then he's murdered and, they think I should talk to someone. And, of course, my mother wanted anything to help. My dad, of course, was trying to come back and forth and help.
Yeah.
My Aunt Lorraine, I had just a village. And so they took me to this guy and I'd go in his office and he wouldn't say much, but he'd write a bunch. And I would think.
Therapists love doing that. They love that.
So I'm thinking, hey, this guy's a ripoff. You know, I'm doing all the talking. He doesn't do anything. But every single time that I left that visit, I felt better.
Yeah. You needed that space.
Exactly. Oh. So over time, I said, you know what? That's a pretty cool thing that guy does. I wouldn't mind doing that.
I love that. So it was your experience in the therapy room and with somebody who you trusted, or at least got you to that point where you could trust them.
Right. Exactly.
Inspired you to do that.
Yeah. And what ended up happening after going, it wasn't something that my friends really understood. It was still very much taboo within my community, as it is in a lot of communities, or was in a lot of communities. So I became that sounding board for my friends.
Yeah.
Not necessarily trying to do interventions, but more or less, I realized that, intently listening to someone is sometimes better than attempting to come up with a solution.
And we do not do a lot of that, the listening portion. I feel like so much of the world we live in right now is all about providing solutions and also making things easier, making it so like, let's just make it. And I love how much you talk about the importance of like going through tough stuff.
Yes.
And gaining resilience.
Well, you know what? I challenge parents whenever I have the opportunity to do parent academies, parent universities, or even on television.
Yes.
And one of the things that I ask is stop stealing your children's heart.
Mm. Tell me about that.
So I'm a father of eight, and from 21 to 35, four grandchildren.
I mean, amazing.
So stealing their heart, using my children as an example, would be, and I did early on as a new parent, because we can't stand to see our children suffer, not realizing it's through those challenges that they know what they're capable of. Yeah. It's not about us. We want them to have resilience, but self-resilience, self-concept, self-esteem. And that's not parent based. So
right. Self-esteem, parent esteem, right.
Exactly. Yeah. So when they steal their heart, an example might be a child working on an assignment. And the minute they run into something, they close a book, they don't want to do it anymore. I'm done. I'm just going to turn it in like it is. Parents oftentimes will say, hold it. You know, let me work it with you and that kind of thing. Where my thing would be open it back up and look at it again.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it's so important for that to teach us that lesson. You know, why is that overcoming or working through those things so important for personal growth?
Well, first of all, how do we know who we are if we haven't been through anything? Right. You know, so the biggest issue in at least my sessions with people today in my practice is the fact that some of the things that they're coming to see me for, I have to tell their parents that, you know, I'm going to do this session pro bono. And the reason I'm going to do this session pro bono is because what you're coming here for really should begin at home.
Yeah. So, I mean, so much of the things that parents bring their kids to therapy for have to begin at home.
And it's not necessarily, just to give an example, maybe like a hangnail, because that's how I would perceive what, you know, Sarah doesn't sit beside me anymore at lunch.
Right.
And it's the end of the world.
Right.
So, of course, yeah, you could sit here and you can listen to me from a psychoanalytic, analysis perspective, and, you know, tell you what it is, or you can talk to your daughter or your son about the fact that not everybody's going to like you, and that's okay.
That, I think, is a really hard lesson. Not everybody's going to like you. Not everything is going to go your way.
Exactly.
Not everything is going to work out. You're not going to get
Yes.
And not all of life is like a 10. Most of it's like 3 to 6 on the scale.
Exactly.
Most of the things we do suck. Brushing your teeth, boring. Making the bed, awful. You know, but somehow we go through that. So, you know, you do a lot of work with parents, and how do you encourage parents to have these conversations? How do you get these parents to kind of switch that? It's almost like the work they have to do, right? Like their own emotional regulation when they see their child or partner. I mean, I even do this in my own relationships where I'm like, I'll just handle it. You know, it's like easier that way. So what is the responsibility of the other person? Like not the person maybe going through the difficult thing, but the person who's steamrolling everything, making it easy.
Well, recognizing that the two largest roles of parenting are guarding and guiding. Hmm. Guarding and guiding. So often, as human beings, we think of stimulus, response.
Uh-huh.
But guess what? There's something in between called choice. And children have to learn how to make good choices. We can't make them for them. We won't always be there to do it for them. And then I also have to encourage parents, once they get that, they're not out of the woods, because then I have to say, hey, and don't tether yourself to the choices your children make.
Ooh, that's a big one.
And when I say that, if your child's a straight A, honor roll student, I might say help your child have more fun, but I might also say, no. But I might say, the parent's like, yes, you know, I've done that. But then if that child gets expelled for, you know, some disruptive behavior, then you own that as well. So the key is, you know, give your child the onus of having earned those grades, putting their hard work into it. As parents, we guard and guide, whereas the children put in the work and make the choices.
Yeah, and you know, it shows we're not all one thing.
Exactly. You know, so our children aren't miniature versions of us.
Yeah.
Every child is a study of one. So with 8 children, I have 8 uniquely different personalities.
And 8 children, that when you had 8 children with such a wide range in ages, you are probably a different not a different version of yourself, but maybe a different, more evolved version of yourself as you parent each of those children. What was that like?
And that's evolved is in a perfect world. In a not so perfect world, is tired.
Okay. As a more tired parent, so that's funny.
So what happens? You know, the first child, our oldest, is Kyle, and you know, Kyle looked at how we would rear his younger siblings. Uh-huh. It's like, man, if I had did that, let me tell you what would happen. So as a parent, I guess. What happens over time, like you said, evolve, but also you understand that it's not a life or death kind of situation. It's not like if my kids don't eat, if they eat gluten,
right,
you know, they'll be okay.
Right.
You know, it won't be the end of the world if they have some. So that kind of thing, where when you're first starting, you know, there's no textbooks for this. Well, right. So when you're first starting, you're trying to do this and do that and make sure of this. I remember wanting Kyle to have like a really good Christmas and birthday early on.
Yeah.
And he would play with the boxes that the toys came in. So lessons. So you learn all those lessons. And I think those lessons just help you be not only a better person, but a better caregiver, a better guardian, a better all the things that children need over time. And, you know, there's a difference in Kyle, just outside of personality, than the younger children. And what we see is that Kyle, if you were to talk to Kyle at 35, he'd say, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, yes, sir, no, sir. Yeah. He's that guy.
Yeah.
And that's who we were. And that's what we were teaching.
Yeah.
and it wasn't that it wasn't important. It's just as time went on, it became more of an issue with lazy language with our younger children. So if you call their name, they said, yeah, huh?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And you're like, no, yes.
There were definitely, there were only 3 siblings in my family. And the third one, it was like, he was saying whatever the heck he wanted. I'm like, we weren't allowed to call each other stupid. We weren't allowed, like, no
yes.
way. That would be like the worst than a swear word. And my younger brother, nobody cared. Nobody was even pussy. And I, let alone like 8, I couldn't imagine.
Yeah.
How do you see yourself change? I mean, besides just the tired thing.
Yeah. So I became more tolerant of things. So we have to remember that we were once children as well. So one of the things that really challenged me, not only as a parent, but as a psychologist, an anthropologist, and other things that I do, when I was growing up, we had these commercials called "This Is Your Brain on Drugs."
Oh, I remember.
And it would have egg frying.
Yes.
Okay. So and prevention back then, they really understood prevention. Prevention is repetition. I tell parents, stop saying I shouldn't have to say that again. Children learn best.
What a good point.
Adults learn best when we hear it over and over again. That's how children. So if you tell your children don't open the door for strangers, it's not a one-time conversation.
No.
That's a conversation you might even take them all the way into their adulthood.
Yeah. I heard it was about 75 times or something like that.
It is.
Yeah. It's, okay,
exactly.
Good. I think I had that number right. Yeah.
It's
like
real.
75 times you have to say that. And I feel like the same also goes for boyfriends in my experience. So I don't know what that's about. But,
I would say it's about, could be about girlfriends, but I think we're created just the tad bit differently, and if I were to say that, I probably would be single.
Yeah, you probably would. Oh, that's funny. Well, you know, I think teaching that lesson of embracing those difficult moments is the best thing that we can do as a parent, and also the best thing that we can do for, like, ourselves on the daily. You know, this is something that so many of us have to face, but I feel like I feel like that is often the thing that I work with clients the most on, is learning how to manage uncomfortable feelings. That this is going to be, there are going to be difficult things that happen, and our mindset and how we view these problems is the thing that's going to help us get through it, or like basically like suffering is a choice. Well, let's take a quick pause. You know, we are looking for ways to support us being healthier in mind, body, and spirit, and Allo Moves is here to help you do exactly that. I recently came across Allo Moves, and now my whole mindset has changed on the easiness and availability of being able to prioritize my own wellness, because they have an app that gives you everything in one place. There's yoga, Pilates, fitness classes, mindfulness, self-care tips, healthy recipes, everything that you want. I've recently been using it for sleep because, my sleep has just been messed up. So I am all about their art of sleep, like section that they have on Allo Moves. Yeah, I love it. The art of sleep. They have so many different things on this app that help me just be in line with a healthy lifestyle and get back to the basics, really. From beginner to advanced, Allo Moves has the flow or the class that'll fit your schedule. Their classes range from 5 minutes to an hour depending on what I'm feeling today. And you can unlock your personal wellness routine with Allo Moves. Go to allomoves.com and use code TCE30 for an exclusive 30-day free trial. Enjoy 20% off of an annual membership. That's allomoves.com, code TCE30, allomoves.com, code TCE30. All right, back to our show.
I agree wholeheartedly. I think feelings have stories. Mm. And it's up to you to decide which story you're going to attach to that feeling. And you have that power.
How do you help people reframe that mindset or find that power to tell a different story?
Well, I talk about backpacks quite a bit. And I talk about that when I talk about trauma, that everyone has an invisible backpack that we don't share. However, it's usually things that we don't really want to know ourselves anymore. It hurt going in, so we don't want to deal with it, but we're carrying it. And just because it doesn't look heavy doesn't mean that, you know, our knees aren't buckling.
And sometimes you get so used to the weight of that backpack that you don't even notice that you're carrying it, huh?
Exactly. But others do. Because, the saying, we're only as sick as our secrets. Now, I'm not saying, you take out the stuff, and share it with other people. I'm saying you have to know what you're carrying. Otherwise, whatever's on your plate is going to be fed to those you love. So, we can't necessarily heal what we don't reveal. So everybody's afraid to go into that backpack because it hurt going in. To your point, it hurt going in. The hard part's over.
experiencing it is the hard part.
The hard part's over. Okay. Yes. Are you going to feel some pain addressing it? Of course. But you've already been through it. So guess what? Let's get it done.
Isn't it weird how our mind tricks us like that? My mind will say, you will not survive that. You'll die. And it's something I've already overcome.
Right, right. And it's grossly out of proportion to precipitating events, as most things that we do. But you got to remember, our brains were designed to keep us alive. However, the brain does this thing with kind of like a go fish. It does a match. Uh-huh. And it doesn't mean the brain's correct. It basically does matches based on our exposure and our experiences for efficiency's sake, not effectiveness sake. So the brain does this kind of black, white, good, bad. Okay. But the majority of our life isn't black, white, it's gray. So that true thinking occurs in the gray. And true thinking, the way it's operationalized, is actually rare. A lot of there are quite a few people who allow the brain to tell them.
Right. It's more reactive, right? It's not
exactly.
Like, yeah.
It's not proactive at all.
How do we get to that place?
Well, you
of wise thought, thinking.
One of the things I think that we could do is to not believe everything we think.
Right. I always say that on the show, feelings are not facts.
Exactly. The
thoughts are not facts.
Yeah, exactly. Stop believing everything you
that,
think.
That it is not always true, but it is so hard to change that. You have to really raise the awareness and mm-hmm. put a lot of intention into it.
Definitely. I give my clients a balcony band, and I can't call it a balcony band as opposed to a basement band.
Taking
a little bit off of some of Freud's work, where balcony is we've emptied our backpacks, we've ascended to the balcony of life, not only for ourselves, but in the balcony we can cheer for other people. We also have balcony people in our lives who are cheering for us. Basement people, on the other hand, and not judging them, but understanding them, are people who have such heavy loads and they don't have the coping capacity or strategies to empty it. So these are the people in our life who, when they wake up, their brain does exactly what our brain is designed to do. They wake up and they look for opportunities to be offended. Right. Now, I say it that way, but the brain actually scans the environment for an enemy, for a threat.
Right. And that's really what it's doing. It's in protection mode.
And that's what So when we have a person that wakes up and they're looking for opportunities to be offended, that's that survival mode. Yeah. So, and a lot of it has to do with the stuff that we're carrying. That interferes when we're not present, purposeful, and intentional. Because, you know, how can I be present if I'm carrying the weight of the world in my backpack? Right. You know, our past is a place of reference, not residence. So we really have to do a better job of being where my feet are.
Yeah. Taking your mind out of the past. Yeah. And so step one, recognize that you have a backpack.
Everybody has one. That's
step
not something.
Step two, open up the backpack.
Open up the backpack. It's going to hurt, but remember that it won't be as nearly as bad as when it went in.
Yeah. And it almost sounds kind of like this is, you know, sometimes I'll talk to clients about, you know, the journey, like to get like kind of like the high road, or the like take the high road, take the low road. And it's often that feeling of it's lonely on the high road. I can imagine somebody who's been wearing a backpack, a heavy one, walking around with a bunch of other people with heavy backpacks on, the idea of ditching that backpack leaving that would be really scary.
Oh, definitely. Because one, you've become accustomed to it. It can be a habitual. But at the same time, you mentioned other people being around them. You know, we heard the saying, misery loves company. Misery loves miserable company. That's the saying. That's the saying.
Yes. Misery loves similar company. Exactly. Misery hates the other company.
Exactly.
I know, because I am the optimist, and people who are miserable hate being around me. They're like, no, she's fake. I don't like her.
They don't know. They don't get it.
They do not get it.
And that's okay. It's okay. I attempt to still try. And if it just comes to a point where sometimes they're projecting and attempting to bring me to the basement, my go-to is, I hope you heal.
Yeah.
Which is also
the ultimate stab. I hope you heal. I'm going to use that one on all my enemies. I'm kidding. No, it is. It is such a wonderful, and it's so true. And that I joke because we have to laugh about it, but it is the truth that anybody, it's as cheesy and cliche as that hurt people saying is that there's accuracy to that.
Definitely.
The truth that people with those really heavy backpacks are in that self-protection mode, and it can also make, just like you said before, other people seem like a threat and very unsafe. But as you mentioned, one of the things that was such a protective factor for you were the people and that group that you had supporting you and encouraging you to talk to the right people. Connection and relationships is so crucial, right?
So what's interesting, those were crucial and so powerful. And everyone's telling me, take a leap of faith. Everyone's saying, go hard and you can do anything. Take risks, you know, calculated, of course. And then I become that guy. And it scares everyone. So my mom, I finally, I become a professor. Well, okay. I started off as a, every step was kind of when I became a teacher, a middle school teacher, my family's yes, yes. Oh. I was the first in my family of five to graduate high school. So everybody's yes, yes. So then when I decided that I want to go back, I want to be a professor because the things I saw in education wasn't because people weren't great people, is because they didn't have the knowledge or content to help all students.
Right.
So I wanted to go in higher education. Now my mom's like, hold it. You have job. You have a great insurance. You have this. And how you're going to, so then, because they told me this, they told me I could do it. I go into higher education. I go into higher education. They give me all the rules. They tell me, this is what you need to do to get tenure. You need to publish. You need to be a peer review. All this, I become a tenured full professor at a really young age. All right. Families. Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah.
Then I decide that I'm going to travel the world and provide masterclasses. I'm going to leave tenure. And oh my God. So every single time, so they did this. They made me into this person that was fearless and fearless to the extent that I can tell you I'm successful because I failed so much.
Yeah.
Most people, you know, in shows like this, you know, we talk about our highlight reels. You know, I would love to tell you about the cut footage and how that cut footage made me who I am. But I became that person that knew that, hey, if I fall down seven times, I'll get up nine or eight. So tenure. Then I travel the world now, masterclasses. And so mom's like, okay, and seems like you have a plan. The next thing, she looks up, I'm on television. So the point is, it goes back to say, they believed in me to such a degree that self-efficacy, I create self-efficacy from their belief in me, that I knew that with heart and hard work and my faith, that I could attempt to do anything. And I say attempt because I wasn't always successful the first time or the second time. Sometimes it took three or four times, you know, and I'm constantly looking for challenges. And not like I'm saying, you know, I'm going to do that because it's a challenge. When I think of something that I want to do, you know, I look at all sides of it and I say, whoa, I don't know how to do that. But hey.
You're not limited by the challenge.
Exactly. By no means.
It sounds like the pushback that you got a little bit was like they had seen maybe how you could excel and they saw that spark in you. They saw what you could become, but still were limited by their own, like, the end of their own beliefs or their end of the, like, they couldn't see past what they didn't know could be possible. Like if they knew, okay, he could go to school, he could be a professor. They knew you could do that, but like maybe TV wasn't even on, like, in their realm of possibilities. So it was like they were limited by their own limiting thoughts of where you could potentially go. And for you, you were like, sky's the limit. I can go anywhere.
That's
and
what they
so
said.
It wasn't. There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. So it becoming graduating high school. Well, I can tell you, for me, my goals weren't very lofty at all based on my environment. An internalized goal that I had early on is I wanted to live past 18.
That would be I'm going to say maybe a low bar but it may be very important if it's something that you haven't seen in grew up with.
Exactly. My neighborhood was nicknamed the Bermuda Triangle.
Oh, because people disappear.
Exactly. Oh. Exactly. You could be in your bed. Oh, and it's still happening to a degree. You know, we had a kid sitting at his dinner table, I think maybe 8 or 9, eating with the family, and a bullet came through and wounded him. Didn't kill him. But the point is, my community was that random happening kind of thing. So my thing was, I want to live past 18,
and I never shared expectations for yourself.
Exactly,
that is
exactly.
Such a hard thing to have on your heart.
And people didn't understand that because a lot of people didn't grow up in environments like I did.
Right.
So So
it's not even a thought that would cross their mind. That's what
exactly.
I mean by low bar, because it's like, I exactly. wouldn't even think about that because that's exactly. not a threat.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So graduating high school, yay, everybody's right, cheering. Mm. High school counselor said, hey, you're smart enough. Your grades are good enough. Your SAT scores will actually get you a scholarship. So college next.
Yeah.
And just there were some choices I made that were still connected to my environment, to the point that I hadn't been far away from home. Mm-hmm. So I had acceptance letters from like Yale, Brown, and Princeton, and I live in Virginia Beach, Virginia. So, you know, my mom basically told me that if, you know, you go that far, it's going to be really hard to come home for like breaks and things, you know, but we're going to try. And that in of itself, like, nope.
Right. So, and you're from a big family with a lot of people around. You don't want to leave
exactly.
on that.
Exactly. So my counselor told me that the College of William & Mary would be a good fit based on all of the things that I'm considering. And I went and found the best education of my life, found my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And again, highlight reel, she wasn't my wife, but we dated, became parents when I was a sophomore. And she was a freshman.
That's a different college experience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we were kids ourselves, yeah. and stayed friends and made it work, but also grew up to come back.
Oh.
So I'm not afraid of that.
Grew each on your own.
Yeah.
In so maybe those ways you needed
yes,
to.
Yes. Right. So you know, I love the cut footage. I think that's the missing part. When it comes to children will look at us and think, oh, everything's easy for us. We woke up and went to college, got degrees and had a podcast show and all this other stuff.
Right.
That cut footage is something they need to see and see how we dealt with it. It's okay for our children to see us fail. It's okay for our children to see us frustrated and agitated.
Yeah.
The issue is, I think sometimes we hide that not only from our children, but from most people.
Right. Talk about how that looks. Like, say, you know, I think especially in a relationship, parents are often like, I want to hide the fights away from my kids. I don't want kids to see any of the disagreements that we had. And, you know, I've been in relationships where it's difficult to have healthy discussions because those were often hidden. So they weren't witnessed.
Right.
By partners growing up. I mean, my family was in the other direction where everybody yelled a little too much. Everything was a little too out in the open and I had to like find the happy medium. But what advice do you have for parents who maybe have that belief of, or people who grew up in those environments where it was like, oh no, we hide fights away or we don't let anybody see us right. having any difficulties.
Well, I think that goes back to truly there's a lot of merit in the cliche saying of we're only as sick as our secrets. You know, when we contain those, it's almost like the fact that you can stuff something like like you can stuff an emotion or bury an emotion alive. It's impossible. It's constantly fighting. It's constantly fighting for air and it's constantly trying to get out. And when it gets out, you don't necessarily have when you suppress it, it can come out anywhere.
Right.
Anytime on anyone. So that's what I mean. I'm not the person that will ever advocate that children don't see parents disagree. I'm not that person.
Right.
I think children should see parents disagree, but I also think they should also be around and see what happens.
The resolution.
The resolution.
Yes.
You know, now we
yes.
have to have conflict resolution taught in schools as well. But when parents allow children that privilege of being right there, I mean, we take family trips together. Back when the kids were, we drive across country. Come on, of course we're going to argue about directions. We're going to argue about where to eat.
Right.
I don't want to listen to your station.
I don't want to sit in that chair. He always gets that chair.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So yeah. So I like it when it's out in front, and also parents sometimes will almost even in the moment, knowing that the children are watching, will sometimes model. More appropriateness than if the children weren't.
Right.
And the saying, of course, more is caught than is taught. Children are watching. They're watching.
So much. And if you think they're not, they are.
They're watching.
They pick up on vibes.
Yes. Oh, come on. Come on.
They're just like, something's
up. Empaths are real.
Yes. And kid, and the, I feel like parents who hide it more, the kids are, they have to learn, like hone those skills to be able to like pick up or read those. If parents have explosive emotions, if they can't control them, kids have to become experts in.
Yeah. Well, that's like growing up in an alcoholic home.
Right. Right.
You know, kids are hypervigilant. I mean, that's, you know, I think the only place that I know that that will serve anyone is like a profession like the CIA or FBI. Well, no, like really, they want you to.
Yeah, hypervigilance works there. Yeah. And I would imagine the burnout in that career is pretty.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So relationships, a super important part of being able to that foster that resilience and that well-being. And it is like a parent's duty. And oh man, so many of us got a raw deal with the parents being able to do that though. How do we build that when we don't have that as an example?
Right. And I like the fact that you said raw deal and you didn't call it trauma.
Yeah, just because, a raw deal.
Right. Because parents do the best they can with the information they have at the time they have it. So, you know, I tell people that want to come to me after gone to other people, you know, they wrote letters to their parents and they did this ritual. And I talk about a snake bite. You know, mm-hmm. if a snake bites me, a poisonous snake at that, I'm not going to run after the snake, search for the snake high and low and find the snake and say, hey, why'd you bite me? I'm a good person.
Right. You don't need to dwell on the, right. So, yeah.
I have poison in me. Uh-huh. I have to take care of me.
Let's get that. Yes.
Exactly. So.
Oh, that's such a good way. I'm going to use that one.
Please,
that's a very good one.
The difference between a victim mindset and a survivor's pride.
Yeah. And you know, I have a lot of clients when they first start work with me that will often be worried that that's what it's going to be like in therapy, that it's going to, they don't want to go and revisit those memories and they don't want to go find the snake.
Right.
And they go, do we have to do that? And I'm like, no, why would I want it? I don't, that's done. We can't fix it. Let's talk about what we can do moving forward.
So I would say that I meet more people in the mental health profession that do believe to, you know, you should find the snake. However, I say on my show all the time, you know, at the end of every topic that we're talking about, therapy works.
Right.
And when you look for a therapist, there's guidelines all over the place that tell you the questions to ask. My favorite question is, does your therapist have a therapist?
Yeah, so important. Shout out to Sherry. I love her. She's mine. I always give her credit.
So, and I say that because, It can be quite pejorative if you don't. I mean, in the program that I went to, that we had to choose our favorite modality and then undergo it. And the program was really set up in such a very self-empowering way and self-awareness way. The very first course I took in graduate school, a professor comes in, there are 11 of us, and he says, welcome to the wonderful world of clinical psychology. It's obvious you know you're broken.
Well, geez, that's an intro. Okay. I would have been like, why do you think I'm here?
And I'm thinking, literally, I'd gotten to the point where, you know, I felt like I had a cape, you know?
There were a few of those in my program as well. Right, I remember them. Yeah.
Right. So I'm thinking I have a cape. I'm looking around like, you're not talking to me. But you're talking to everybody.
Uh-huh. All people.
Exactly. So that was humbling. And when you can do that, it actually, it helps you extend grace. You know, that's not a word that we often use.
I love that word, though.
Therapeutic context. And, you know, grace is not earned. You know, grace is like, it's just given freely.
Yeah. We just have, you're given grace.
Right.
Benefit of the doubt. Maybe we can use it like that. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So that just helped me get past all the stuff that usually just keeps people coming back. You know, I think a good therapist or your work with a good therapist should recapitulate life.
Yeah.
Life's not forever. We all got these sandglasses you know, and you know, the saying doesn't stop.
Right.
So, you know, to keep coming.
Relentless.
Exactly. To keep coming back and coming back. I get it. But I want you to actually live.
Yeah.
That's the goal.
Get out there and live.
And do it. And do it. And do it big.
I love that. Well, before we go, there is one other topic that I wanted to unpack with you a little bit. Something that comes up. We get a lot of questions about this. In my practice, I work with a lot of people who are first responders, nurses, things like that. Well, and even just being like a human in this world today, burnout is a real thing. Burnout is something that so many of us experience, and burnout, and you do a lot of work talking to mental health professionals and helping people kind of coach people through these feelings. So, tell us a little bit about what that is, how we kind of get there and how we help.
So if I were to pull my, I guess, journal from maybe a couple of years back off the shelf. So they explain the difference between burnout and compassion fatigue. So burnout originally came about based on like the Industrial Revolution, you know, when people were just working tireless hours and just not resting and not the nutrition failed and other things. Compassion fatigue is a little different because compassion fatigue. So recovering, and you would know this well, recovering from yard work is a lot different from recovering from a marathon session with a client.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. So mental exhaustion is
exactly. Tired in my heart.
Exactly.
I don't even know how to explain that.
There was some research that said something like 3 hours of total engagement and intentional engagement is analogous to 8 hours of manual labor.
Because I've even told clients that after a therapy session, it might feel like you just ran a marathon. You might get sick afterwards.
Yes.
You might need to take a nap. You might your body, you can get symptoms of the flu.
Yes.
of this stuff that physically.
Exactly. So the compassion fatigue has to do when you're not working with widgets, nuts and bolts. On the railroad, so to speak.
Yeah.
Compassion fatigue is when you're working with other human beings and you're giving of yourself, not necessarily, you know, just a repetition of hammering or screwing something in. You're constantly giving of yourself. So that's what I would like people to kind of look up and think about. There's lots of books on it. Compassion fatigue is what we get in human interactions when we overcommit, when we're not taking care of ourselves. You know, my favorite question to ask anyone to gauge whether or not their self-care is on point, I'll ask, if I asked you to write a list of all that you love, how long would it take you to add your name to that list?
Oh God, I was like, he's not going to get me on this. I got it. I know. I'm on my list. I would not have even thought to include me.
That's my point. That's my point. Our name has to be at the top of that list.
Doc Brown. That is going to be my big takeaway from this, is where is your name on that list of the things that you love? Oh my God. And even just like, I am one who is so bad at that. Is my lesson to learn. I am working on that, you know, cause like I'm a therapist. This is what it takes a long time for us to learn how to do this.
It does.
And I mean, I could feel instantly the tears like start to well up as I even just think about how scary it is to even include myself on that list.
Right.
How it's and like,
No, you have to be at the top, and that's self-care, and it's not it's not selfish. It's that self-care when you have taken care of yourself as a happy, whole person. Imagine what you can do for others.
These interviews always end up turning into my own. I like somehow sneakily make them my own therapy sessions and end up crying on everyone. I'm like, oh God, that touches my heart. That is so true. And it is, I know you guys listening struggle with this because you write in and you talk to me about this and it is a real thing. So where are you on that list? You cannot even start with taking care of yourself if you've got 1,000 other things that are a bit more of a priority than you. This is that air mask, like airplane, put the
thing. Very much so. Look, I'm noticing your bracelet. So when I was telling you about basement and balcony earlier, they have a balcony band.
Yeah.
I borrowed from the cognitive therapy folks, snapping every time you have a thought that doesn't necessarily, that you don't want.
Yeah.
A thought that's maladaptive, a thought that is actually detrimental, self-defeating, snap it.
Okay, that is the tool. Put on, have a little rubber band bracelet.
Yes,
give
exactly.
it a little snap, and you're training your, you know, and I do this with clients, and in my first session with them, I tell them that I'm going to be very annoying in the first few sessions when I hear, like, nobody ever talks mean about my clients, including my own clients, to about themselves. So if I hear you talking mean about one of my clients, yourself, I'm going to interrupt, and I'm going to say that we don't talk like that to our
I love
our
that.
Friends. And so then it gets so annoying when I do that, that then I don't have to do that because they go, I don't want to do that because I don't want Sarah to interrupt me.
I love that. That's a drop mic. That's a drop mic. I love that.
That's it. Well, thank you so much for coming on our show. I just like, I could sit here and talk to you for like hours. Where can people find you? Tell us about your TV show. If people
sure.
want to hear more.
Sure. My website is docspeaks.com. You can go to docspeaks. It also docteaches.com. So I do both. And I have a podcast. It's a Patreon. It's called In the Balcony with Doc Brown. And I have Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, Adolph Brown, docspeaks.
And if you don't follow him, you definitely should because you go live and you talk to people in the balcony all the time, inviting people, come on up to the balcony.
Yeah, I do.
Yes. So guys, make sure you're following him so you can come on up to the balcony because it's nice up there. And thank you so much for coming on the show. I would love to speak with you in the future and can't wait to just see all the stuff that you have coming out. And thank you much for doing the work that you do and helping people in the way that you do.
Likewise. It was a pleasure being up here.
All right. Thank you. And we'll see you next time on This Changes Everything.